From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Police in Berlin say the person they arrested yesterday for allegedly driving a truck into a crowded Christmas market may not be the right person. The man they arrested is a young refugee from Pakistan who had applied for asylum in Germany. And that's adding to tensions in a country divided over how to handle Europe's refugee crisis. NPR international correspondent Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson is in Berlin. Soraya, what do we know about this man?
Well, we know that he's 23 years old, as you mentioned, that he is from Pakistan, and he had come to Germany last New Year's Eve to apply for asylum. His case hadn't been decided yet. He was living in a refugee home. And then he was also known for apparently being a petty criminal. He had committed some smaller crimes, and so police were aware of this man. And then last night, maybe an hour or so after the attack happened at the market, they found him near the Victory Column, which is about a mile and a half away through Parkland. If you have to picture this at night, it's not exactly lit up. And so they apparently, based on witness reports, said this was the man they thought had run away from the truck after plowing into these people. And so they arrested him. And apparently since then, they've been interviewing him and they've been, obviously interrogating him. And he has not confessed to the crime. This is what the Attorney General and also the Interior Minister told us today. So the Attorney General says they have to operate on the assumption that he might be innocent. I guess they're missing other pieces of evidence that would allow them to keep him. And so there has been no arraignment, and he would have to be released if they can't make the case.
Well, police are also saying that they found a Polish man shot dead in the passenger seat, indicating this might have been the hijacked driver of the truck. But what more are we learning about this terrible event, this truck plowing into this marketplace?
Yeah, I mean, it was a tractor trailer, so it had some weight to it. It was going at pretty high speed, and it went about 250 feet into the market, sort of plowed through scores of people. In the end, you had 12 dead. That included the Polish national that you said was the truck driver, that they think was the truck driver. He was shot, apparently, in the passenger seat. The identification's been really difficult, is what authorities are saying. They've identified six of them, apparently, as German nationals. They don't know about the rest yet. They're also having a hard time with the critically injured that are in the hospital. There are six that are reported to still be in very, very grave condition, and they haven't identified all of those people yet.
Well, Angela Merkel, in her comments, said that if this were somebody who had been seeking asylum, it would be further disgusting. I think I'm sort of paraphrasing what she said. She's already under criticism for allowing so many migrants into the country. Last year, more than 1 million refugees arrived in Germany, almost 500,000 formal asylum applications. This has to be adding to that debate, even though we're not sure if the man arrested is the one who actually did the attack.
Well, there's no doubt that that has, in fact, inflamed the discussion and arguments. So you have people saying that you can't have hundreds of thousands of undocumented migrants running around because this is bound to happen. You know, someone is going to be radicalized. Merkel made it pretty clear, though, that she felt that this was the day to grieve. And then the people who are responsible and all those other discussions should be held later. As you mentioned, she did say it was repugnant if the suspect turns out to be the perpetrator, that a migrant who's seeking asylum would have done this is repugnant, not just to Germans who work with refugees, but to the refugees who actually are trying to integrate into German society.
Yeah. NPR international correspondent Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson in Berlin. Thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Yesterday's attack compounds the debate over Germany's response to Europe's refugee crisis. For more on that, let's turn to David Miliband. He's in New York, and he's president of the International Rescue Committee. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Yeah, it's good to be with you.
So first of all, given all that we've heard about the terrible attacks yesterday in Berlin, and that at least initially there was some concern that a suspect might have been an asylum seeker, I mean, what's your thoughts, your response to what happened yesterday?
I think anyone has a first thought that it could have been me. It could have been anyone in that market there. And so utter condemnation and horror at the event must be the first human emotion. I think the second thing speaks to the rather bigger picture that you've raised, is that the tone that's been set by Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, which is that the facts have to be gained before people start offering opinions on the lessons of this horrific killing, it seems to me to be absolutely right.
Now, of course, Chancellor Merkel has been criticized roundly by many. Not, of course, not everybody, but many people for being so welcoming to refugees and migrants who seek to come to Germany. I want to speak with you more broadly in a moment about the refugee situation globally, but staying with Germany for just a moment, I was seeing that the German Interior Minister described some problems with processing of asylum applicants. You know, specifically, he was talking about the case of the man who was held as a suspect yesterday, saying that several attempts to hear this man's initial claim failed because he did not appear for assessment. And then at a later hearing, when he finally appeared, that hearing failed when the suspect claimed he spoke Balochi, a language which German officials didn't have a translator for. So are there issues in terms of how asylum seekers are being processed in Germany?
I'm sure there have been some administrative glitches, but the message that I got in Berlin, and I talked to people from all over Germany at a meeting that included discussion of this issue, and they spoke to a real seriousness of purpose in Germany, that they realize that this is a global problem, that the Middle East is on Europe's doorstep and needs attention in the region, but also that Germany has responsibilities to live up to its own values. And I think that we have to hope very much that the shock of yesterday's event doesn't disrupt that determined approach that Germany has, which is to be practical, but also to live up to some high ideals.
Well, 2016 has been yet another year where the refugee and migrant crisis has been brought into sharp relief. Can you give us a sense, now that we're at the close of the year, what the refugee situation is worldwide? How many people find themselves in this terrible situation?
This year, the figures will show that there are around 25 million refugees around the world. There are also 40 million people who are displaced within their own country. And the war in Syria, which has been in the global headlines and in your headlines, especially over the last week, has really become the poster child for these wars that spill out masses of people. 5 million refugees from Syria, 5.5 million refugees from Syria, leaving the borders of those country, of that country, and going to Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, the neighboring states, and then onward to Europe in the case of about 850,000 of them. And that is part of the global refugee crisis. And one very important element of it is the greatest load in hosting refugees is borne basically by poor and lower middle income countries rather than rich countries like the US or European countries. The vast bulk of refugees are in countries like Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Kenya, Ethiopia, Pakistan. That's where the refugee load is the greatest. And that's why I think it's right to see this as a global problem that needs global attention.
Well, you mentioned Syria, and you also talked about internally displaced people. There are, of course, many refugees leaving Syria, but many people are forced to, for example, have been able to get out of Aleppo but still have to stay inside the country. I mean, what are the challenges for those refugees?
We've got people today, my own staff, 20 kilometers to the west of Aleppo, and they are reporting terrorized civilians fleeing the fighting, fleeing for their lives. And it's very important to recognize that in addition to the 5 million refugees, there are 7 million homeless within Syria. And those are people who are now waiting to see the next stage of the government offensive. Does it repeat the indiscriminate bombing, the door-to-door murder that has been a feature of the Aleppo situation? And I think that we would be right to say they're genuinely in fear of their lives. And we as a humanitarian aid organization are on the front lines trying to provide support in water and sanitation, in healthcare, in sometimes cash support to these people who've fled with nothing. And it's very important to recognize that the toll of wars without law, wars without end, is borne by civilians who are left with very little to show for the lives that they've built up.
Well, David Miliband, final question. With the tens of millions of people who you described to us who are either refugees or internally displaced, do you feel any optimism for 2017 that the tide can turn? Because I don't get a sense that the conflicts that are creating these humanitarian disasters show any sign of abating.
Well, you're right, I think, to say that there's a real danger of a vacuum of international leadership in 2017. And the great danger is that the five-year Syrian civil war burns on, that the situation in Afghanistan takes a turn for the worse, that the long-running conflicts in Somalia and Congo are untended. And one of the great lessons of 2015 and 2016 is that problems in places like Syria or Congo or Afghanistan don't stay within Syria or Congo and Afghanistan. They spread out. And that's why they become a global phenomenon and a global problem. And so I'm afraid it's not my job to bring, or my possibility to be here as Santa Claus bringing Christmas cheer about the humanitarian state of the world. What I can say, and what I think is very important for listeners to hear, is that they can make a difference. And I know from the work that we do, helping 23 million people around the world last year, that the spirit of generosity and compassion is strong. And the greatest danger we face is that people give up on that.
David Miliband, president of the International Rescue Committee, many thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Since President Obama took office in 2009, there have been 931 disaster declarations, most recently those terrible wildfires in Tennessee. And the response to almost all has been led by Craig Fugate, the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. He steps down next month, as Obama does, and in an interview with Bloomberg View, he did not hold back, questioning why the feds essentially subsidize developers who build in coastal zones vulnerable to hurricanes, storm surges, sea level rise. He asks, why don't we call these people out and say they're socialists? Craig Fugate joins us now. So socialists, you say developers are saying, hey, private insurers won't risk covering us, but the government will. No problem.
Well, there's this argument that I saw in Florida where we know there are places that are more vulnerable to develop, and the only reason we can build there is because of things like the National Flood Insurance Program and disaster response. And my question was, why do we keep growing the risk? Why is it not getting smaller? And the answer is we set a rate of subsidy below which people change behavior. If you're underwriting the risk as a taxpayer, and that's the thing I want to make clear, is this is you, the taxpayer, you're underwriting the risk. Where's your benefit from this? Or is this solely the benefit of those that are able to develop and build in high-risk areas because you underwrite it?
Talk about that phrase you just used. We're putting the threshold underneath what makes people change behavior. In other words, people are saying, oh, you know what, we've got so few requirements, we'll still get the federal government to cover this if anything goes wrong. Why should we change anything and do anything different?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that when I talk about the federal role, people don't always understand that what FEMA pays for is what is considered uninsured losses. So every fire station, every school, every courthouse, every public building that we put money into, that's because they didn't have insurance. And my question is, if the private sector doesn't think it's a good risk or it's not affordable, have you considered maybe building back differently or in a different place? But as long as we're going in and providing reimbursement up to 75% of those losses, there's not much of incentive to change behavior over the long term.
Well, are you saying that, I mean, it's one thing if a town or municipality really can't afford the private insurance to cover a building that maybe they know is not up to code with everything that's been developing in climate change. They just can't afford it. There's a difference between that and knowing that, you're just not going to change things because the federal government will cover it.
Well, absolutely. And that's why when we do go in after these disasters, we ask the question, what should we build this back to? And too often we end up only looking at past data, not future risk. And so what we're trying to say is we ought to build back to insurable risk so that we rebuild it one time with the taxpayers' monies. But then the private sector is managing that risk for the long term, not the taxpayer. But if we're building something new, why aren't we using the same tools of building it so it is insurable?
Yeah. Well, you have made a suggestion, or FEMA has, under your leadership, a disaster deductible. What's that?
Well, right now, when you talk about public assistance, and this is not for the families that were impacted,
right,
this is for the governments, that we have thresholds based upon a per capita per state population. So it's $1.41, so you multiply that by your 2010 census, and that is the threshold for your uninsured losses that the president would consider declaring a disaster. But when we declare that, we always go back to the first dollar. So if it was $25 million, we're going to go back to that first dollar at 75%. Now, that's not how most insurance works. Most insurance has deductibles to encourage you to take actions to minimize filing a claim. We think that setting a deductible of at your threshold, so that if your disaster was $25 million, we pick up the first dollar after that, and you own the first $25 million at full cost. and then go, if you're doing things to buy down risk, let's give you credits to buy down that risk. So building codes, land use, preparedness activities, things we know that will reduce the cost of future disasters. You buy your deductible down, just like you can get credits as a driver or a homeowner for activities you take to buy down your risk. And if you don't like my answer or my suggestion, understand that the IG and General Accounting Office would like to double to triple that disaster declaration so that you're going to go from $1.41 to over $2.80 to as much as $3 to $4 per capita. My recommendation is don't raise the threshold, create a deductible, and try to incentivize good behavior and reward that through the deductible process.
Well, you're talking about the public part of this equation, towns and cities. But when you talked about socialists, you were talking about builders and developers. And as you said to Bloomberg, people running around saying they're capitalists and they're Republicans and they're conservatives and it's all about individual freedom and making money and growing the tax base and all the BS, you say, they throw at, I mean, this is strong language, they throw at people. It's nothing but socialism and social welfare for developers when you subsidize risk below which the public gets a benefit. They've got to be called out. You're calling them out.
Yeah, well, this goes back to my experiences in Florida, and I've seen this up and down the coastal communities, where developers fight for developer rights to build in areas that are subject to storm surge from hurricanes. And the only reason they're able to do that is because they have a short transaction period, and their exposure to the risk is minimal. So they can go in there and build, they can reap their profits, and they are out of there.
Sounds like the banking crisis.
Yeah, but who gets left with the risk? The taxpayers, the local tax base, who now has an exposure that may not have made that great of a contribution to the tax base or to the jobs. These tend to be very temporary jobs. Yet in a disaster, this tends to be the most vulnerable property. It costs the most to respond to. It is those areas that you spend the bulk of the federal dollars on. And the people that went in there and built and said this is, you know, going to add jobs and add tax base had already made their money. And I'm not saying development is bad, but it needs to be in the character of, do we fully understand the risk to our tax base and what it will cost to respond to this development in a crisis, and have we factored that into the overall picture, or are we picking up those costs unintentionally or uninformed while other people have made their profits and moved on?
You talk about how much of what insurance and these considerations are based on is past weather data. It's time to look to future weather data. But there's a problem there because not everybody agrees on the future. Well, science does, but you've got a president-elect, Donald Trump, who's questioned climate change. You've got his nominee, many of them, but his nominee to the EPA, Scott Pruitt, who has. What happens to FEMA when you've got people at the highest levels of government who don't even accept the science behind the work you do?
Well, if you don't like the science, let's go back to where investors are willing to put their money in risk. Capitalism is about rewarding those investments that make you money and taking money away from those that don't. So if you can't get insurance to invest in your development, to invest in rebuilding, that might be the sign it's not insurable.
And the government, the federal government, should not then be your insurer.
Right. Let the private sector, you know, when you talk to reinsurance and other large, you know, large organizations that deal with risk, historically, they've looked at changing patterns. They've looked at future growth. They look at the types of things that are going to affect their investments. They basically make their investments based upon that risk and their understanding of that risk. If they're not able to invest or make available insurance because we haven't accounted for future risk, that should be the sign we're not building to the future. If we are, we should be able to get insurance. It should be affordable, and it should be the standard practice of letting the private sector manage the risk versus the public sector, you, the taxpayer, managing that risk through your subsidies and tax dollars going in after disasters.
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be, in the foreseeable future, what they're calling managed retreat, moving people from at-risk areas?
Well, that may be a new concept to some. FEMA's already been doing that all the way back to the Clinton administration, where we've had repetitive loss communities that in some cases it made more sense to relocate the community than to rebuild back only parts of it. So this will really come back to how many times can you rebuild before it is no longer economically feasible to mitigate or build back resilience in those communities. And as we start seeing these patterns of coastal impacts as well as other impacts of climate disruptions, we're going to have to make a decision. At what point do we basically say enough's enough, let's move, we can no longer continue to subsidize this risk, it's bad policy.
Yeah. Craig Fugate, what would you say to the next FEMA administrator?
Well, I would tell them that in looking at the arguments that we declare too many disasters, that the threshold is too low, resist the temptation for simple answers of just raising the threshold. Look at how we can build incentives to buy down future risk.
Make people change their behavior, not just,
This is true of anything. If you want to change behavior, the pain point has to be at the point where people are willing to change. They want to change. They don't want to continue doing it the way it has. It's no longer something they can adjust to. But if you set the pain point too low, if you're coming in at thresholds that don't change behavior, and again, we're talking about societal behavior over large scales, not individuals, we'll see the risk grow, and we will constantly see the cost of disaster rising, but we won't have done anything to buy down that risk. And so the trick is don't get hung up in what's causing this. Look at the investment, and always remember, every time FEMA goes out the door, it is the taxpayer that's paying for that risk. Did the taxpayer get a benefit from that, or are we subsidizing risk below which communities and local officials change how they're managing their risk profiles?
It's Craig Fugate, outgoing administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Craig, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
So, should developers and towns accept more of the cost of disasters and offset that cost by changing their building behavior? Your thoughts welcome.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
When can law enforcement legally track people using their cell phone data? A House committee is calling on Congress to pass a law that would provide some clarity on this question. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is responding to a Wall Street Journal investigation from 2014 that revealed federal investigators were using cell phone data to look for criminals, often without search warrants. The Wall Street Journal's Jason Bellini joins us now from New York. Hi there, Jason.
Hi there, Magna.
So at the heart of this issue is a technology called cell site stimulation and is deployed from airplanes. What is that?
Well, if you don't mind me correcting you, Magna, it's cell site simulation, not stimulation, but that's all right.
So
it essentially mimics a cell phone tower. It's a box that's in a plane, usually a Cessna, flying over an area, and cell phones will be drawn to it as it indicates to them, this box, that it's the nearest cell tower. And then what this allows them to do is scan tens of thousands of phones at a time and hunt for a single suspect's phone. The journal is also reporting that the U.S. Marshals Service developed the technology with the help of the CIA. And the device really helps them determine which phone belongs to a suspect's, and then the idea is that it lets go of non-suspect phones. So they're just really looking for that needle in a haystack, and the types of encryption that works on most of the phones that we use, including iPhones, that doesn't throw off this device.
Yeah, so today's the day of corrections for me, because earlier I said they're using it to track criminals, and I want to correct myself. These are suspects, right, which is why this is an issue, because, I mean, when the data is collected, do law enforcement agencies even need a warrant to do this right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it was a real gray area back in 2014 when my colleague Devlin Barrett first reported on this program. And at that time, no, they didn't need warrants. The issue now with this investigation by a House committee is what the future of this should be. Right now, the Justice Department, they say they've revised how they go about doing this. And now they do ask for warrants, but not in all cases. You know, it's up to you know, judges to determine. But at the same time, this is still a program that does a big, wide hunt, pulls, you know, attracts phones from people, from you and me, if we happen to be in the area where they're using this.
Right. So I'm seeing that the report from the House committee says that until there are clearer rules around how and when this technology can be used, that the Justice Department and Department of Homeland Security should not fund this technology for local police. That's pretty serious. So what's expected to happen?
Well, yeah, at the moment, as far as we're aware, local police are not using this technology.
Right.
The committee also found that the Justice Department has 310 of these devices. Department of Homeland Security has 124 of them. So that's quite a few when you think about it that could be flying in the skies above many cities. So is there collaboration going on with, you know, local police? At this point, we really don't know that. But we're not I think that they're really – this House committee is saying – no, the local police shouldn't have it up on their own planes. That the feds should have this tool, and they need to figure out what the guideline should be for how to use it.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Magna.
It was April 15th, 2013, Patriots Day here in Boston, when bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. That's some of the sound recorded that day. In the new film, Patriots Day, it is ear-splitting because we are there. In the crowd as three are killed, dozens lose limbs. We're in the manhunt for the bombers, the Tsarnaev brothers, there as they wage a second battle with police in quiet Watertown, Massachusetts. Patriots Day is written and directed by Peter Berg. In this scene, shortly after the bombings, then-Police Commissioner Ed Davis, played by John Goodman, and Kevin Bacon's FBI agent Richard DeLaurier debate whether to call it a terrorist attack.
Gentlemen, the moment we label this terrorism, everything changes. It's not about Boston anymore. It's not a local investigation. It's Wolf Blitzer. It's stock markets. It's politicians. Knee-jerk reactions, anti-Muslim backlash. And what if we're wrong? I mean, there's no take-back. I've been through this before.
If we don't call what we already know it is, and a cell is activated and they hit Chicago or New York or Washington, what happens then?
The accusations are going to come no matter what we do.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Good to see you.
Nice to see you. How's everything?
Yeah.
How are you? Pleasure. How are you?
Native Bostonian Mark Wahlberg co-produced the film and stars as police officer Tommy Saunders. He and Peter Berg tell the story of real first responders, real survivors. They even incorporate film of a real recent marathon in which survivor Patrick Downs ran on a prosthetic, his wife Jessica Kensky Downs at the finish line. Many of the real characters attended last week's Boston opening, and we spoke with Mark afterwards, asking about his memories of the bombing.
I came in town the very next day to go and see my mom and my family and see if everybody was okay. It was one of those things where, as you started coming out of the airport, you'd never seen the city like that. It was deserted, and it was a very eerie, uncomfortable feeling.
It's a lockdown and just an unbelievable 4 days. What was the most important thing for you to get across?
The strength, the love, the heroic acts of our brave men and women. Being a Bostonian, I always had my sports heroes to kind of look up to and put on a pedestal. But the brave men and women of Boston redefined the term hero for me in the way they responded in the face of this tragedy.
Your character, is it Danny Keeler? I mean, I've heard it's a composite of many of the police.
Yeah,
but
well, the two big inspirations for the character are Danny Keeler, who was put in charge at the finish line, and also Bobby Murner, who was involved and basically went on his own pursuit and was with Billy Evans when Joe Carr was eventually captured in the boat.
Bill Evans, the current police commissioner. And Danny Keeler, I think, was also instrumental in the search for Jahar and the Tsarnaev brothers. What is it that you wanted to say? Again, a composite, but here's a guy who has knee hurt. You know, he's having problems at home. What is it you wanted to say?
You know, these guys had never been faced with something like this. And they had seen quite a bit. But in talking to them and gathering how disturbing it was to be in a situation like this, yet how they just found the energy to continue to keep going and never give up, and they knew the responsibility that lay on their shoulders to protect the citizens.
They were scared. Your character looked scared at times. I mean,
they were definitely scared. I mean, you look at even the officers in Watertown; those guys had never even fired their weapon in the line of duty. This was something completely new to everybody, and then working with other law enforcement agencies, it was new for everybody.
It was a cluster.
Yeah, it was, and I told Pete it's okay if there, because there was really a lot of conflict, but ultimately people came together and figured out how to work together.
In this scene from Patriots Day, Police Chief John Goodman and Kevin Bacon's FBI agent debate releasing photos of the suspects when Wahlberg's local cop breaks in.
Those are not our guys. Meanwhile, you guys aren't any closer to identifying the two we're really looking for. We need to release those pictures.
If we release the photos now, we have zero control.
If we overplay our hand, we may force these guys to react.
Gentlemen, if I may, right now, Boston's working against us. Yeah, that's normal. You got to murder, no one rats. We don't got that problem. Because in this city, when it comes to terrorism, everybody wants to talk. Look, you got a lot of people talking, but they're talking about the wrong people. You release the photos of our guys, sit back and listen, trust me. You gotta start letting Boston work for us, I'm telling you.
The behind the scenes in Patriots Day is fascinating, but the violence is crushing. Take the too soon question. Emotions still very raw. A lot of people have PTSD. People in Watertown where the shootout happens with the Tsarnaev brothers. We have a colleague, it was right outside his house.
To kind of, just so you can understand how sensitive we were to all of that, when we talked about shooting in Watertown and reenacting the shootout there, they did a survey of 200 people. 199 people wanted the shootout to happen there, and one person didn't. So we said, okay, we're not going to do it there.
The parents of Martin Richard, who was the little boy who was killed in the bombing, standing right next to the bomb, they didn't want any reflection of their family in the film. That's difficult because they were at the center of the bombing. You know, what you did was show this little covered body with a state police officer standing there.
Yeah, and that officer was not going to leave until the body was removed.
Well, it turns out it's without showing something. It's one of the most devastating moments in the movie.
Yeah, well, I think having them having to see the movie, sit through the movie, seeing us basically reenacting the worst day of their lives, but to know that we honored their word, I know they were appreciative of that, and then they were kind enough to give us a picture of Martin to put at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, when it comes to other people not wanting the movie made, I was probably one of those people for a time, but then they were going to make it anyway. So what do you do? Do you just kind of hope that somebody else is going to get it right and be respectful? Or do you have, you know, dreams of somebody coming in and making it gratuitous and exploiting our community? That on top of the enormous sense of pride that I felt and seeing how my community responded, I felt like, you know, should make the movie. And the message of the movie is not too soon.
Well, it's interesting, just as a little aside, talking to one of your colleagues upstairs, he was saying, you know, I see it as almost a group therapy session. And that's kind of how it felt in the theater.
Yeah, certainly last night. I mean, the hugs. I had never been, I've seen the movie many times, and I'm always getting emotional seeing the movie. But because of all the people that were there and everything else last night, I had a hard time holding it together. But I also felt like one of the greatest and crowning achievements of our city is how our people responded.
How about for you personally? Is this also redemption, a little bit of redemption for you? You grew up, you had a tough time, there was an assault charge when you were 16. You're now portraying a cop, and you were one of the kids the cops were chasing.
Well, now look, I grew up right over there.
Pointing out the window.
I got into a lot of trouble, you know, basically left to my own devices. I'm the youngest of nine kids. My parents did everything they could to provide and just put food on the table. We were, you know, around and influenced by a lot of bad things. And I've been spending a long time working on turning my life around and redeeming myself. This particular movie did not play a part in that whatsoever. But I am appreciative of the fact that I can use my real life experience in playing these parts. And I think is a very fine line, as we all know. or certainly at least I know, from somebody going the right way or the wrong way and becoming a cop or ending up being incarcerated. While making this movie, I ran into a lot of guys that I hung out with on those streets that became cops, and happy that they didn't either make the mistakes that I made or get caught for doing the things that I was doing.
The theme of love. You show Patrick Downs and Jessica Kensky making love before heading off to the marathon. Their feet are intertwined. We know those they're going to lose those limbs. But the love...
Well, the whole entire movie is about love, and love always conquering hate and good, always being victorious when faced with evil like this. But I remember Pete and I sitting at the finish line watching Patrick finish the race on a running blade, and I just spoke to him briefly, and I still asking him how he found the courage and the endurance to be able to do that. So seeing him finish the 26.2-mile race and then embracing his wife at the finish line.
She lost both her legs.
Yeah. Well, one of the heads of the BAA came right up to us, stuck her finger in our face and said, "That's what this movie better be about. That's love. You know, people in Boston, they're not shy. They're going to come up to you and they're going to tell you how they feel." And everybody said to make sure we got it right and to show them what Boston Strong means and who we are as a community. And that's why, ultimately, it's a positive thing.
Mark Wahlberg, who produced and starred in the new film Patriots Day. For more on the film's opening, go to hereandnow.org.
As families gather for the holidays, some parents will try to pass down antique furniture, collectibles, and family heirlooms to their adult children. Those items may have sentimental or financial value, or sometimes both, but many baby boomers are discovering that their treasures aren't valued as much as they expect. Christina Estes from Here and Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
There we go. Come on out.
Inside Claudia Kunkel's garage...
I see it's a little dusty, isn't it?
...is a 3x4-foot piece of reddish-brown wood supported by a pedestal base.
And this is the old Duncan Fife dining room table.
Less than 3 feet high, it stands tall in her mind.
There were five of us kids. Used to sit at it and do homework. And I guess I think the most important memory is that Dad bought it for Mom when they were married. And I think that's kind of special.
Kunkel has cherished her parents' table for four decades through four states.
It's been in every home that we've had. It's gone across the country, starting in Iowa and moved to Colorado, to California, and now Arizona.
Now that she's no longer using the table, Kunkel would like one of her three daughters to take it. Her oldest, 33-year-old Susan Kunkel, is her best chance, but no guarantee.
It's not exactly my style, but I do appreciate, you know, family heirlooms. I would like to keep it. I just don't have the space.
It's an interesting transition that I'm seeing going on.
Andrea Brundage is a professional organizer. She works with a lot of baby boomers who are downsizing.
Well, I think millennials are more disposable, and they've also seen us be burdened down with too much stuff, I think.
When kids reject their parents' dresser or grandma's china, it can cause hurt feelings. Brundage has felt the pain herself. She was sure her daughters would fight over a dining room table, but neither wanted it. Brundage eventually sold it at a yard sale to a man who planned to give it to his daughter.
And of course, I just got very emotional because that's where that table was supposed to have gone.
A lot of older brown furniture makes its way to EJ's auction and consignment in Glendale, a suburb of Phoenix, where owner Eric Hoyer says business is booming.
Probably tripled in the past 5 years, and the amount of estates that we're doing from the baby boomer generation because the kids don't want it. Or they inherited it, they don't want it for their house.
Behind the showroom, where visitors can view items featured in weekly auctions.
Let me pop you in the back here.
Is the processing area.
We have five moving trucks. We're picking up a minimum of one estate a day.
This is where items are unloaded, sorted, and cataloged. In one corner, a talking doll dressed in red, white, and blue is propped under bright lights waiting to be photographed while an employee conducts research.
So we're part of organizations that give us very large databases to be able to research and find out what the fair market value of something is.
Delivering the news to clients sometimes requires sensitivity, especially when dealing with antiques. That's anything more than 100 years old. Since the recession, Hoyer says the antiques market has tanked.
They're not collecting that stuff anymore. The people that are collecting that antique furniture are the ones selling it.
Another example is porcelain figurines, commonly called Hummels. The collectibles were popular in the 70s, but not today.
You know, those $300, $400 pieces are now, we'll group them together now in lots of three or four just to try to get $50 for them.
Hoyer estimates they turn away 60% of what they see. Rejection can be tough, as professional organizer Andrea Brundage knows, but she reminds herself and her clients that parents should never burden their children by forcing items on them they don't want.
And so when you put it that way to most people, they're reasonable.
Back at her garage in Phoenix, Claudia Kunkel gets it.
It's like, oh, I wish somebody would take it. But you can't feel bad because I had my own taste as well, you know, and they should be allowed to decide what they want in their home and what they don't want in their home.
If her children don't want her parents' rectangular table with the curved legs, Kunkel admits it might be time to let it go.
The value is really in the memories, isn't it?
For Here and Now, I'm Christina Estes in Phoenix.
So speaking of memories, what about memories of just this past year, Robin? Some people are looking back on the year as one big dream, which is why Merriam-Webster, or maybe why, Merriam-Webster Dictionary has chosen surreal as its 2016 word of the year after searches for the word spiked on its website. I did search for it. Why not? Surreal dates back to the 1920s and the surrealist movements of artists like Salvador Dali, and it means, quote, marked by the intense irrationality or irrational reality of a dream. This would be surreal if I can make it through this. Merriam-Webster reported a spike in people looking up the word after the Brussels terror attacks in March and July and the July attack in Nice, France. But the biggest single jump was on November 9th after Donald Trump won the presidential election, which, Robin, brings us to another one of Merriam-Webster's top words of the year. Take a guess.
Bigly.
Got it. And in fact, it is a word, an archaic form of big. Became famous when Trump seemed to be saying that in public remarks. The president-elect has clarified and says he was saying bigly.
We did an entire segment on that word. Here's two more words. Thank you. It's the time of year when our Here and Now interns fly the nest. So thank you and safe flight to Elena Eberwein. She's heading off to work with international students studying in and visiting the U.S. Lucky them. Elena, thanks for your research. And let's just keep those trips to the vending machine between us. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now.